Great. Good afternoon, everyone. Those of you who are now coming into the room, great. It looks like everybody, it looks like the numbers have slowed down of people who are coming into the room today. So thank you everyone for being here. I did just get a message. The tribe will be joining us today. They are just wrapping up another meeting, but they've asked us to just go ahead and get started, and they will join us as soon as their meeting is wrapped up. So we'll go ahead and get started. Good to see everybody. This is our first Taiklot Steering Committee in the new year in 2021. So it's good to have everybody here. I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome back Councilmember Mello, who will be joining our group again. He is now joining us as, not as a city council member, but as a county council member. So he'll be representing the county council. And you may be familiar with his work as he started this committee as a city council member and was on the sub-area planning committee. So welcome, Councilmember Mello.
Thank you, Mayor. It's good to be back.
Good to have you. All right. So thank you, everybody, for joining us. We have a packed agenda today. We only have a couple items on the agenda, but they're pretty meaty. So we're going to go ahead and get started and jump right in. And why don't we, just for the sake of people who might be new joining us for the first time, can we just go around and introduce ourselves? I already introduced Councilmember Mello. So Commissioner Meyer, can we start with you? Just everybody, your name and what organization you represent.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm Commissioner Don Meyer, Port of Tacoma Commission, and I'm enjoying the sunshine out here in East Pierce County. So thank you.
Thank you, Don. Lisa?
Hey, my name is Lisa McCall, and I'm a city council member from the city of Fife. Also enjoying the sunshine in Fife.
Mm-hmm. Lillian?
Good afternoon. I'm Lillian Hunter from the city of Tacoma, council position number 6, and also enjoying the sunshine. We'll take it. Thank you.
Kim.
Hello. Good afternoon. I am Kim Roscoe, council member for city of Fife with the extra title of mayor. And just love to point out that Lisa is in one of our oldest neighborhoods, Furwood, and it's beautiful over there.
Great. John.
Good afternoon. I'm John McCarthy, Port of Tacoma Commissioner, and Commissioner Meyer and myself will continue to be the port representatives for 2021 on the steering committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner McCarthy. All right, with that, we will get started. And the first thing on our agenda today is a motion to, I'll entertain a motion to approve the agenda.
Madam Mayor, I move.
Oh, sorry.
I got a motion. Second, okay. Commissioner Meyer, thank you. And Councilmember Hunter, thank you. All right, if there aren't any questions or comments concerning the agenda, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? All right, the agenda is approved. We're moving on to item number B, communication items, and I am going to turn that over to Stephen Atkinson, who will roll those. Thank you, Stephen.
Great, and thank you, and good afternoon, Mayor Woodards, members of the steering committee. I'm Stephen Atkinson. I'm a principal planner with the City of Tacoma's Long Range Planning Division. And I certainly want to just acknowledge our other project team members here representing the other governments and invite any of our members to go ahead and join me as part of the communication items and introduce themselves to the audience as well if they choose to. So first, we got a couple of communication items that I'll help introduce. And then happy to introduce a couple of members from our Moffitt Nickel consultant team. They'll be walking the steering committee through a discussion item related to climate vulnerability and sea level rise. Our first communication item today is a fairly straightforward one, but wanted to just make sure that we're being really transparent on this issue. So next week, we're going to be having a Tide Flats Advisory Group meeting. As part of that meeting, we're using that as an opportunity to work through essentially a dress rehearsal for some of our visioning sessions that we expect to be occurring in the next few months. So what we wanted to let you know as part of this communication item is we had a commitment within the work plan that we all agreed to that those advisory group meetings were going to be public meetings. We do have a technical challenge with that for our advisory group meeting next week. So essentially when we have Zoom meetings that are set up with panelists, much like today's meeting with the steering committee, where we have panelists and attendees, if we want to be able to transition to small group discussions and breakout rooms within Zoom, we don't have the flexibility of having one group of people that continue to be participants with audience members. Either everybody is participating or we really can't conduct the breakout room. So thing we just want to make sure that we're being really transparent about is we want to use that meeting to kind of work through some of those technical challenges with Zoom and conducting these workshops. So we intend to move forward with the meeting, but it won't be open for general public this time. But we will be documenting the conversations as well as any discussions that happen as part of that. And just wanted to convey to you all that this is not going to be a shift in how we're conducting business with the advisory group. It's really just for this one meeting while we work through some of the challenges with the Zoom technology. So again, just wanted to daylight for our audience as well. We do expect that meeting, but it won't be open for general attendance the way that it has been in the past. Second, the next communication I'm really relating to our upcoming schedule, and I wanted to really take this opportunity to try to take a little bit of a step back from where we are and provide a little bit of overall context for where we are in the planning process, and then give a little bit more, hopefully, meaning to the scheduling that you see as part of the agenda packet. The next major milestone for the steering committee will be a recommendation that we're planning on in June relating to the future alternatives that will be used to feed into the plan development and environmental impact statement. And so everything that you see in that schedule between now and then is really designed to try to inform you and set you up to be able to make that recommendation in June. And that's a really key recommendation within the process because the rest of the kind of first phase of plan development and draft environmental impact statement really depend on kind of that next milestone being able to move forward. So it's a really critical piece. In terms of sort of what that means, big picture, so we are currently compiling the baseline reports and we will be able to share that coming up. So you'll see in the agenda in March, we intend to have a joint advisory group meeting and steering committee meeting to go over some of the key findings from that baseline analysis, as well as some of the implications for the next stages of the process. So what that really does is when we're thinking about the alternative development process, what we want to be able to know is, as best we can, what do we know about the tide flats today? What uses are there? What development patterns? What environmental conditions? What do we know about our air quality, our water quality? And likewise, what do we know about all the plans and programs and development regulations that already affect what happens in the port tide flats? And then from that, once we know that piece, then we can start to look at the 30-year, 40-year plan horizon and say, if development were to occur under a business as usual approach, no changes to our current planning framework or regulatory framework in the tide flats, what kinds of things might happen over the next 30 or 40 years, and what would the potential impacts or outcomes look like for the community? And then we can start to say, now working with the steering committee at that point, what could those other alternatives look like? Are there certain uses that we want to prioritize over other uses? Are there opportunities where we could look at what if we did X instead of Y? How might that then affect what happens in the tide flats over the next 20 or 30 years? So that's the phase. Once we develop those alternatives, those will really go into the environmental review so we can compare the environmental outcomes from those three different future development scenarios. So it's a like I said, it's a major kind of milestone in the process. So what we want to equip you with is the information on our baseline conditions. So you have kind of a full assessment of what we know about the conditions in tide flats today. Likewise, what you'll see in that schedule is a really significant community outreach effort between now and that May to June time period. So in February, we expect to have the community kickoff on February 4th. That'll be our first big open community discussion, kind of laying out this process for our community groups. Following that, what we're looking at is around six visioning workshops between late February and March, which will really be focused on gathering input on the future and the goals that we have for the Tide Flats. So we'll be getting our community's input on what those goals should be and what that future could look like. Those meetings will be structured at different times of the day, different days of the week. We expect to have a weekend meeting. And we're currently looking at potentially having one meeting that would be really focused on underrepresented community groups within this region. So a very targeted outreach effort to get people to try to come to that meeting who might not otherwise attend one of the other broader meetings. And we're also considering, you know, ADA accessibility within Zoom, sign language, translation, and interpretive services to make this as open and inclusive as possible. So again, our intent in the next few months is to conduct that significant outreach so that when we are at that point in May, that we can essentially equip you with that input from our community as well as the data and analysis that you need to start to make that next recommendation. So just in terms of some of the details, like I said, community kickoff will happen in February. In March, we expect to conduct a joint session with the advisory group and steering committee, starting to unpack the implications of the baseline reporting. We'll have a series then of the community visioning workshops. Following that in April, we expect to provide you with a written communication summarizing what we heard in that community outreach, then leading into a May and then June steering committee meeting to work through the alternatives development process. And we currently have a placeholder in July. Just depending on how that conversation goes, if we need a little bit more time, that we'll have a placeholder in July for that final meeting. So that's hopefully gives at least a little bit of context for what's happening and what it's supposed to add up to. I think in the last year, I think we've certainly felt that kind of building to this point has taken more time than we probably wanted. And we obviously had some impacts from the COVID pandemic and kind of delaying the community process. But at this point, I think where maybe people felt it's going a little too slowly, our message here today is partly we expect things to start to happen really fast. And so that's going to be part of the message on February 4th for our community is really laying out what to expect, when to expect it, what it's going to mean, and how we're going to use that information as part of this process. So right now, all of our communication staff are working really hard to make sure that we are all coordinated and providing the communications we need to really create, I think, the energy and attendance at these community kickoff and visioning meetings that I think we're all hoping for. So with that, I would just say in introducing our consultant.
Hold on before you jump to the next item on the agenda. I just wanted to open it up for questions. Mm-hmm. Any questions of Stephen and the information that he just presented? And Stephen, let me say I appreciate the fact that you are acknowledging some of the frustration, but some of the angst about wanting to go faster. It seems like this process is taking forever, but thank you for that. So I'm going to call on Commissioner Meyer, and then I'll call on Mayor Roscoe.
Thank you, Mayor Woodards. Stephen, thank you for the context setting process. But one of the things that when you talk about baseline, considering, you know, our focus on economic development and economic data, where will that baseline information come into play? You know, I'm thinking about, you know, the idea of wage levels inside this employment, you know, center, taxes paid, and those sorts of things. Where will the economic data come in on your baseline scenario you referred to, Stephen?
Yeah, and I appreciate that question, Commissioner Meyer, because I think there's a good connection there as well between the baseline review and then the kind of future alternatives development. So the baseline report is more of a snapshot of what we know about the port Tide Flats today, and that does include some of the economic data that you are thinking about. So how much employment do we have? What do the wages look like? How much growth has there been in different industry sectors over the last 10 years? But it is a little bit more of a snapshot in time of where we are today. But the economic piece and then the sea level rise piece today are important as almost like bridge studies. Because I think with economics and with climate change, we both recognize that, you know, the past isn't necessarily predictive of what's going to happen over the lifespan of this plan. So with both the economic piece and then sea level rise, what we're trying to look at is what do we know about today, but then what are we assuming is going to happen or the trends will be over the next 30 or 40 years. So we have an idea of what industry sectors we expect to grow, you know, what do those trends look like, and then we can help inform you in that alternatives development to think about, now, what does that mean for you in crafting what you think the future of the port could look like? So we are getting some of that today, but it'll also be an ongoing development process as we look at some of those future trends and perspectives.
Thank you.
Right. Mayor Roscoe.
I just wanted to, for the benefit of anyone watching or listening, that was a great summary of what we can expect for the next 6 months. I just wanted to point it out, it's at the very end of our agenda, three pages, shows that whole timeline, because I was like scribbling my notes. And February 4th is a pretty special day. It's my birthday.
Well, we did that. Happy birthday to you, Mayor Rocco. How wonderful. And I see that Chairman Sterud and Councilmember Annette Bryan have joined us as well. So welcome to the two of you. All right. Any additional questions or comments? Yes. Commissioner McCarthy.
Thank you, Mayor. Let me just say first, it's my understanding that birthday gifts are suspended during the pandemic, so don't count on much.
I would expect them to never be allowed.
Okay. My question, same, Stephen, has to do with baseline. What year are we going to use for the baseline? Since 2020, because of traffic's down, transportation, economic, it seems like a bad year. So what year are you looking at in terms of baseline analysis?
I'll need to double check that if it was 2019. Because I think given that we started the development of the baseline report in the middle of 2020, kind of late time period, the 2019 data is generally the most recent kind of complete year. But some data sources that, you know, are not as consistently maybe based on the same year. But I think the assumption is generally 2019, early 2020. And then over a 30-year plan horizon. But I'll confirm that and get back to you.
Great, thank you.
Great, thank you, Commissioner McCarthy. Any other questions for Mr. Atkinson before he moves to the next agenda item? All right, Stephen, move to the next item and introduce our consultant.
Okay, and excellent. And just as we kind of wrap up the communication item, then what we hopefully what you'll be seeing from us here fairly soon then will be confirming those dates with the steering committee. And so we've got a really predictable schedule for all of you to plan on and a really good solid sense of what we'll bringing to you at each of those meetings. Just in terms of kind of introducing the sea level rise topic today, as I mentioned, that's a really critical one in our thinking, kind of looking ahead over the life of this planning effort. The intent of the discussion today is not that there is an ask for any major policy decisions to happen today, but we recognize there's going to be a lot of data like this coming forward that we'll want to be able to present to you, kind of let you know what the implications of that data are. And then again, leading to that next really decision from the steering committee in June. So I think in thinking about this discussion, if there, as we listen to our consultant team, I guess one of the things that we'll probably want to follow up with you on after that presentation is if there are specific, might be specific uses, specific types of infrastructure or situations that you're thinking about where you would like to give us some homework. So when we come back to you and start talking about what does all this mean for the development of the future alternatives, if you have some thoughts or questions today about things, particular homework assignments you'd like from us to be able to come back at that next meeting, then that's, I think, kind of the input that we're looking for today from you, or key questions that you'd like to make sure that you get answers to before your next recommendations. So beyond that, I'd like to welcome Stephen Gray and is it Eunice Nori?
Yes, Eunice. Yes, Eunice.
I'll make sure I'm getting that correctly, from Moffitt and Nichol. I want to welcome both of them to the table, and we'll kind of hand it off to them to introduce themselves and present our early findings on sea level rise.
I'll jump in real quick, just since mine's going to be brief. I'm mainly supporting Eunice. I'm Stephen Gray with Moffitt and Nichol. I have quite a bit of planning experience down on the tide flats with both industrial and environmental activities, but really I'm supporting Eunice in bringing together the sea level rise piece.
Good afternoon. This is Eunice Nori, a senior coastal engineer with Moffitt and Nichol, and I'll be speaking today. Stephen is a smarter, so he's going to be listening more. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this presentation. So, Steve, I'm going to go ahead and share my screen. Mm-hmm. Let's see how that works out. All right, Steve, can you confirm you can see my screen?
Yes, I can see it.
Yep.
Okay, great. All right, thanks again, everyone, for taking the time to participate while the sun is out. And the topic today is climate vulnerability as part of the work that the consultant team is doing on the sub-area planning and the EIS project. In general, climate change and climate vulnerability is an interesting topic to both the general public and I'm sure to the stakeholders from various perspectives. The outline of the presentation today is shown here, so I'll provide a brief introduction of what we are going to be talking about and then briefly go over some of the climate hazards we are focusing on. We'll show and list some of the resources and assets that we are looking into, and then talk about the hazard analysis, and that's kind of some of the meat of the analysis. Then we'll talk about the vulnerability assessment, which is work in progress that we are doing today, and then talk about some of the next steps that this study will take moving forward. So as Steve mentioned, today's presentation is mostly for kind of giving you a progress update and letting everyone know that this study is in progress. Some of this is kind of hot out of the oven and we're still working on it. It has to be vetted with different stakeholders, including some of you guys on the call today. So mostly a progress update. And let me see if I can move this around a little bit. So when we talk about climate vulnerability assessment, what is a vulnerability assessment? It basically boils down to these four steps that you see here. And before getting into these four steps, I should mention that I welcome interruptions. So if you have questions, I don't know what the protocol is, but welcome to jump in at any point. So when we talk about climate vulnerability assessment, it boils down to these four blocks. First, we're trying to understand what are the hazards that are relevant and associated with climate for Tacoma tide flats. And then what are the magnitudes of climate hazards, each of the hazards that we identified in the previous stage, and how does it matter for the project area? The step after that is identifying what are the resources, whether it's the infrastructure or built environment, and so basically our resources and assets that would be prone, that would be prone to risk under different hazard scenarios. And then the last step is, when could these scenarios happen and how do we plan for them and build some adaptive capacity? There has been some previous studies, and there's also an ongoing study. Obviously, with different stakeholders, there are different emphasis and there are different perspectives. And so as you can see here on the left, snapshots of climate change impact assessment and adaptation options, the study done for the Puyallup tribe, as well as the Tacoma climate change resilience study that was conducted in 2016 for the city of Tacoma. So we're trying to build on the information that was gathered and compiled and the outcomes of those previous studies. So hopefully we don't go about reinventing the wheel. And then almost in parallel, there's an ongoing study, and it's called City of Tacoma Climate Adaptation Strategy. And so just a heads up that study is also kind of moving forward in parallel with our study, but each of these have kind of a similar and sometimes a little bit of overlapping, focus. But we are trying to make sure that we're not reinventing the wheel and we build on what was already developed. So climate hazards, this is really interesting. And every time I talk about this topic, I get excited myself as well, because the science is really developing. There's a lot of unknowns, there's a lot of uncertainty associated with climate hazards. And so this makes this field really, really interesting. Here we're looking at some of the factors, some of the regional and global factors that have to do with change in sea level, whether it's a global change or regional or local. We can see that the factors range from exchange of water stored on land by glaciers and ice sheets to ocean warming and expansion of ocean water, to then kind of some of the regional factors, whether it's terrestrial water storage or subsidence, land subsidence, and things like that. So a lot of factors in play, and this all plays into that uncertainty and unknowns when we're thinking about sea level change and trying to predict what could happen in future. The best available science on sea level rise. As most of you know, University of Washington Climate Impacts Group back in 2018 released a report on the left. It's called Projected Sea Level Rise for Washington State, a 2018 assessment. And as I mentioned, every few years, these studies have to be updated because the science on climate change is rapidly developing. So at the moment, this study is considered the best available science. And as you know, last year, there are a couple different projection scenarios, and there are always different studies in the works. But so far, this is the best available science on sea level rise projections. And the nice thing about this report is that they kind of took the previous approaches and they've adopted a probabilistic approach to look at sea level rise projections. The graph that you see on the right is showing projected absolute sea level rise under a high greenhouse gas scenario. And the x-axis is showing time. So we're looking at the time horizon. The dashed line is observed value of absolute sea level rise up to 2000s. And then we see different projections with time. So the nice thing about this study is that they've assigned a probability to each of these projection, basically scenarios. And they've quantified and they've come up with a likely range, or the kind of the, what they call a gold area. So now we can talk about these sea level rise projections in terms of probability. So for example, when we're looking at this graph, it's more likely to see this much sea level rise, I'm looking at the, if you guys can see my cursor, I'm looking at the bottom, basically line, a line at the very end. And so 99%, so it's very likely that this line, the sea level rise will exceed this line. And then as we move further up, it gets less and less likely that we would be exceeding the sea level rise, the amount of sea level rise shown here. So for example, it's only 1%, there's only 1% likelihood that the sea level rise will exceed, I think these are, the numbers are in feet, 4 feet by 2100. So now focusing back on Tacoma, again, looking at the UW Climate Impacts Group's study, we can see here that projecting for 2100, they have identified that the likely range of sea level rise varies between 1.5 feet to 3.3 feet. This is for Tacoma. And the difference in between the two lines is one is for a low greenhouse gas scenario, and then the other one is for a high greenhouse gas scenario. So we can see in this range. And then as we if we look at the table listed on the right side, we can see that the projected sea level rise in feet is associated with not only the probabilities, so probabilities are listed on top here, and then we can see different kind of time horizons. So for example, if the length of our study here for the sub-area planning, if the planning horizon is 20 years, so we're thinking about 2040, the likely range for sea level rise is about half a foot to 0.8 feet. So half a foot, 6 inches. If you have your iPhone in front of you, we're talking about that much sea level rise in 20 years. That's kind of the low end of the most likely range for sea level rise. So it's nice to have this study that that provides data and information specific for different areas in Washington. So that's really nice. And then it's tied up to different probabilities. So that makes it really, really valuable. Another climate hazard that we're facing is change in river flow, change in precipitation that causes change in stream flow. In the past couple of decades, we've seen a shift from snow to river. And with more and more precipitation, we're getting stronger peak flows. And with that, there's also a shift in terms of the hydrograph, in terms of the timing of the peak flows that are happening. So let's look at the figure on the left. I'm looking at the figure on the left on the top part. So you can kind of see that so what we're showing here is the stream flow of variation over the month of throughout the year. And so the dark black line is the historical kind of hydrograph, is what we call it, is the change in stream flow over the year. So that's the historical value. And then you can see projected basically ranges for how this chart could change due to global warming, due to other factors. And we can kind of see that we're projected to get more and more precipitation and stream flow in rivers and creeks, rivers such as Puyallup River. This one is a projection specifically for Puyallup River. So the projected value for a moderate emission scenario is to get higher stream flows in December and January. And so you can kind of see that. And the information is summarized in this table. So basically looking at these changes, again, scientists at the University of Washington have come up with these projections. So they are anticipating a change in terms of a shift in timing of getting the peak stream flow of about minus 18 days. So the stream flow shifting towards winter. With that shift, that's associated with snow going to basically reducing snowpack and having more rain as opposed to more snow. 100-year event stream flow they are anticipating a 37% on average, so variation from 10% to 88% change in looking at a time horizon of 2080. So in 60 years from now, they're anticipating that the high or the 100-year return period stream flows could increase up to, 88%. Summer minimum flows are also anticipated to have a shift, both in terms of magnitude and then also timing. As we look at the study area, looking at this figure on the right, I mean, the area is really dynamic. And if I go back to the study area that we have, so here we're showing an overlay of the historical location of the shoreline, which you can see kind of in the darker gray hatches. And then the blue hatches, which are a little bit lighter, those are the actual locations as of today. So you see that most of the area is filled that has been placed during the last several decades. And the area is dynamic because Puyallup River is discharging to Commencement Bay here. We have the coastal flooding. We have the potential riverine flooding. We have a couple of creeks. So a really dynamic area with all these factors at play. So as I mentioned, when we're thinking about the climate vulnerability, we look at the hazards and when we look at the resources and assets. And what are the resources and assets that we have in this area? We have the transportation system, we have the natural environment, as well as the built environment and all the infrastructure in this industrial area. We have utilities, cultural resources, and then we have different types of ownerships. So these are all factors that we need to be cautious about and look at the dynamics and the impact from different climate hazards on each of these assets and resources. So in terms of hazard analysis, we are starting with a coastal and riverine or fluvial flooding. So we're analyzing this type of flooding for the area. This figure is a little bit complicated, so let's kind of walk through the different elements that are shown in this schematic. So let's say I'm looking at an elevation view. So we see land on the left, so that's our topography, and then water or Commencement Bay is on the right side. And so we typically have high water levels and we have extreme water level events. We have some kink tides and so on and so forth. With sea level rise, these water levels are going to increase. So we will see inundation or close to inundation events more frequently. And so what we are calling here a coastal or bathtub flooding is just the water level or kind of the upper range of the water level increasing to the level that the low-lying areas could get inundation, could get either more frequent inundation, during the day when we have the tidal variation. So that's what we call a coastal or bathtub flooding. It's just slow rise of water, and then low-lying areas are the most vulnerable. So that's what we mean by a coastal flooding. Sometimes when wave is involved, waves also ride on top of these high water level events, and then we have the wave run-up and wave overtopping. So that's also at play. So now when we have a river flowing through the area and then joining Commencement Bay, the dynamic is a little bit more complex. So the river is flowing, and obviously elevations are exaggerated here, but it's joining Commencement Bay. And so what happens when kind of the water level at the downstream end is increasing? So the water level that's increasing on the bay side, this is also forcing the water on the river side to also go up. So that dynamic is a little bit more complicated when we're just looking at the river flow, if it was not tidally connected. So that's what we mean. So if you look at this graphic with rise in sea level, the water level in the bay is going up. And then we have the river flow. And sometimes if you get a big rain event at the same time as a high tide, this high tide on the downstream side will force the river flow, river elevations also to go up. So we need to analyze this case looking at interactions between the high water levels as well as the high stream flow event. So that's part of the analysis that we are doing looking at this area. So we start simple with the coastal and bathtub flooding that I mentioned. Basically, we look at the high tide event, let's say mean higher high water, which is not that high, but let's say we have 1 foot of sea level rise, and that's the figure on the left. Most of the shoreline is, we don't see that much inundation. And so inundation is shown if you look at the legend. So here with the darker the blue, that shows more inundation. So as we move from left to right, we're increasing sea level rise. So the one on the left is mean higher high water plus 1 foot of sea level rise. And then we have 2 feet in the middle, and then we have 4 feet on the right. So as we move from left to right, you can see more inundation. And these are mostly because of kind of that bathtub flooding that I mentioned. Water level is going up, and then the low-lying areas are getting inundated, or getting inundated more frequently. And the extent of kind of the light blue that you see here is showing the kind of the extent of inundation. But we mentioned that the potential flooding in this area is not just because of the coastal flooding. There's also the riverine and the dynamic between the two interacting with each other. So we kind of add to the complexity and take into account both elements. So here what you see is, again, kind of the similar scenario where we're going from a 1 foot sea level rise to 4 feet of sea level rise, but we're looking at a fluvial or riverine flooding plus coastal flooding. And so you can kind of see that if I flip back and forth between these two slides, slide 17 and 18, the picture when we look at fluvial plus coastal flooding is much more drastic in terms of that inundation and flooding. So flipping back and forth between the two. Basically, a rise in sea level and that downstream water level could amplify the flooding that we get out of Puyallup River if the two happen at the same time. So now that we focus on and analyze some of the coastal hazards, let's look at the vulnerability assessment. Vulnerability means exposure, incorporating sensitivity, and then adaptive capacity. So vulnerability of each resource, so let's say we're talking about a brackish marsh, or an intertidal marsh. Vulnerability means how exposed is this marsh to the climate hazard of interest, let's say here sea level rise. If it's in a low-lying area and with more sea level rise, it could get inundated. That's kind of the exposure that brackish marsh could have. And then how sensitive is it to that hazard? For example, marshes are very sensitive in terms of elevation. So if they get, if the inundation or frequency of inundation during the day changes, then the marsh plants could really die rapidly. So marsh plants are very sensitive to inundation and frequency of inundation. So we look at the sensitivity of each asset to see how sensitive they are. And then the other one is adaptive capacity. In the case of the example for the marsh plants, is there anything we can do if we see the sea level rise is going up? Can we raise the marsh bench elevation? Can we put in some, basically, some elements to to reduce that frequency of inundation. So this is the kind of the framework that we use to look at each asset that we mentioned: the transportation system, built environment, natural environment, and so on and so forth. So the outcome out of that vulnerability assessment starts with looking and overlaying our assets with the exposure that we had looked at in these graphics that are called exposure maps. So for example, on the left, we have the transportation system, and then we have the extent of the flooding. And we look at that overlay and we assess the vulnerability and exposure of each of the assets that we have in this study. The outcome of that vulnerability assessment is a matrix like the one that's shown on the right. As I mentioned, this is still work in progress, so definitely the results have to be vetted by the stakeholders. And so those are the next steps that we will be working towards. But basically, we would be looking at all of the resources, there's the transportation infrastructure or built environment, and then assigning a kind of a vulnerability factor or metric. And metrics are defined as low means limited areas of vulnerability during extreme conditions, all the way up to severe. Severe is area-wide vulnerability under normal conditions. This vulnerability assessment helps the stakeholders look at the assets that they have and then look at different scenarios of sea level rise or, let's say, change in stream flow, and then gauge the vulnerability of each asset individually and separately against each of these hazards. And then finally, that vulnerability assessment gets plugged into a risk assessment. So we would be looking at each of those assets and evaluating what is the risk factor if no corrective actions are taken. And so for example, in terms of that kind of the brackish marsh, what happens if you don't do anything and sea level rises and there's more frequency, frequency of inundation is more, and so all the plants die. What are the risks and implications of that? Obviously, built environment is a little bit different. Infrastructure is more sometimes sensitive. So we would be assigning a risk factor together, working together with the stakeholders to understand the sensitivity and then assigning a risk assessment. So the outcome of this study, hopefully, adds value for each of the stakeholders and for the project team in general by understanding the priorities. What are the highest risk factor areas and assets, and where should action and investment and long-term planning and short-term planning focus on? So hopefully that will be the outcome of this study that brings value for the team and helps inform the alternatives assessment. So as I mentioned, these are kind of our next steps, and we're excited to be working with you all and also reporting back on kind of the key findings of the study. So with that said, I'll open it up for questions.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much for the presentation and the in-depth information, and not just the information itself, but how you presented it. So can we stop sharing the PowerPoint there? The presentation, great. And then I will just open it up for questions. Yes, Commissioner Meyer, I was going to say, are there no questions? You were so thoroughly good, there were no questions. Yes, Commissioner Meyer, go
Thank
right
you,
ahead.
A couple of questions on your transportation units. You didn't include bridges. Is bridges would be incorporated into your highway segment? But bridges, you know, are a big deal to all of us. And tell me about why you didn't include that. or is it a part of what you call highways?
It is a part of the highways, but that graphic was getting busy just because there are so many elements. They are right now counted towards the highway so far, but you have a good point about maybe separating the bridges.
The other thing, when I kind of looked at the reading through it very quickly, one of the questions I have is first of all, there seemed to be a heavy reliance on other studies, which I think is great. But, you know, when I look and think about all the various goal statements, you know, that this study having that 30-year horizon and all these goal statements that we have as various entities from the city of Tacoma talking about being carbon neutral, the Port of Tacoma talking about being carbon neutral, et cetera, and so forth, State of Washington, Puget Sound Clean Air Agency. So help me a little bit as to, you know, when you start talking about this risk assessment and all these goals. And then the other thing I'm reminded of, you know, this whole COVID situation being a disaster to humankind, but one of the benefits of it was greenhouse gases. So talk to me a little bit about it, and I think it gets a little bit to what Commissioner McCarthy was talking about, is how is this baseline going to be determined and what impacts, if in fact we're successful, and I'm not just talking about Port of Tacoma, I'm talking about City of Tacoma, the State of Washington, we're all focused in around greenhouse gas reductions. So talk to me a little bit about all of these studies and how is that incorporated or just considered to be a blip in the screen, or, you know, how is that going to be considered?
Sure. Great question. So when we think about projections, whether in terms of stream flow or sea level rise, remember that graph with all the different lines that are kind of diverging as the time goes on? That's just saying that there's more and more uncertainty. Think about the weather forecasting. We can look at our app on our cell phone and say, okay, it's most likely that the weather tomorrow is going to be rainy or sunny. But what about next week? What about 2 months from today? Obviously, the uncertainty grows. We can still look at some patterns, but there's a lot of unknowns and uncertainties. As you mentioned, things could drastically change. COVID had an impact on greenhouse gas emissions. So what about that? What about the scenario that they were looking at? Maybe there's a paradigm shift in some of these industries that we are looking at. Or let's say there's an earthquake and the whole dynamic of land uplifting or subsiding, maybe that all changes. So I'll go first in answering this, and I'll open it up to Stephen Gray to see if he has any ideas. But one of the things that we have been working with other clients that have seen success in looking at that is putting the science and that prediction and uncertainties aside for a second and thinking about thresholds that would trigger major action. So let's say I can't say for sure that 2 feet of sea level rise will happen in 2040 or 2050 or let's say 2100, but can I identify a threshold that, for example, this was done for City of Olympia. When you look at the whole stormwater system, they can see that if there's 2 feet of sea level rise, they have to do major adjustment to their infrastructure system. So we won't be looking at a 4 feet sea level rise scenario because it wouldn't make sense, because past 2 feet of sea level rise, they would have to do major adjustment to their infrastructure. So this is the approach that we've seen implemented successfully, that the kind of this projection and the science behind it and the uncertainty, putting that aside and looking and focusing on your assets and resources and identifying the thresholds for the assets in this area in Tacoma tight flats. I don't know if does that make sense to you?
I think that makes sense to me. I guess, you know, this This is all about risk assessment and the timing may be delayed. That's all. I was just wondering how all of this kind of gets wrapped in the study profile relative to the scenarios that you're looking at and the timeline. So it's probably more of a matter of timelines than it is anything else. It doesn't necessarily mean that we couldn't have this two foot of sea level rise, but it's a question of maybe when. So I appreciate that. I just had to bring it up because, you know, we all have these goals and I think they're in a positive, very positive way. And I just want to make certain that at least recognizing this process. The other observation I have in looking at your report is it pretty much tells me a priority has to be around the Puyallup River and the flooding potential that it has as much as a sea level rise change. And for those of us that are in the transportation industry, I'm worried about I-5 continuing to function and any flooding that might happen in the Puyallup River watershed. So I don't know if that's really a conclusion that I have, but I am very worried about that as a priority.
And that has come up through our discussions with the county, with the city of Tacoma as well. So you're definitely spot on. We showed coastal and riverine flooding today, so that's one of the factors, but it doesn't mean that the whole issue with I-5 or local kind of drainage issues or tide gates getting backed up. So that requires another set of analyses. I presented today on the coastal and riverine flooding, but it doesn't mean that we're not looking at the other issues.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Meyer. Are there any other comments? Yes, Commissioner, Councilmember Mello.
Thank you, Mayor, and thanks to the city for bringing this consultant team on board. I think I found the information sobering and very, very interesting. So thanks for getting really local. We hear the effects of climate change globally all the time. Wildfires, we saw those this summer. All kinds of big effects all around the world and in our backyard and in our front yard here in our tide flats. So really, really sobering information. And we're starting to see other manufacturing industrial centers in Pierce County really face the effects like this. I know you weren't charged with studying that, but mm-hmm. we just need to look upriver, right, to the White River and the Sumner Manufacturing Industrial Center, where there are billions of dollars worth of assets that have been underwater and can continue to get underwater. And we, the community, are spending tens of millions of dollars to try to protect that infrastructure and those assets for good reason. There's a lot of jobs there. There's a lot of assets there and a lot of cargo from this manufacturing industrial center, of course, goes there for further logistics. So you're talking about, Alta 2100. I think it's really important for us to remember that the impacts aren't going to show up at the year 2100. They're going to show up in spikes. They're going to show up gradually over time to see the really nasty impacts to our businesses, to our environment, to our infrastructure. It's not just going to, we're not going to wake up on 2080 or 2100 and see a bunch of flooding. It's going to happen soon.
Exactly.
So thanks for that. I do have two questions. One for you, Eunice, and then I think probably one for Mr. Atkinson. For you, Eunice, how often models change because of a lot of factors? Based on what you know, how often do you think the modeling will get updated?
Mm-hmm. So thanks for your earlier comment. I think that's really valuable to keep in mind. Sometimes we are thinking of one hazard because we've seen it happen in our lifetime or in the last decade, but we're forgetting about another one. So I think it's good to keep that perspective. I always think of tsunami that, for example, this region, we haven't seen a recent tsunami, but what about probability of a tsunami? So thanks for that comment. Regarding your question about modeling, so we're talking about different kinds of modeling. What I showed, the projections, those are atmospheric modelings, and they're just looking at climate change. And they take in different factors, rate of ice sheet melting and atmospheric changes in the ocean and things like that. Those are at least on a kind of biannual time frame, they're updated. So every 2 years. And obviously different universities, different research centers, even different folks in the private industry, they're working continuously on these models. But I think at a minimum, every 4 years, IPCC, which is this intergovernmental panel, is basically international panel, they come together, they look at all different models. So it's not just one model that's being run and then you get the results. They come together, look at all different kinds of models, and then they reach a consensus, and then they issue that report. So that report, the IPCC, which puts out the best science available on projections of climate change in general, that's updated every 4 years. But obviously we have different kinds of modeling. Does that answer your question? Were you asking about climate change modeling?
Of course, yeah. I was asking about climate change modeling and how it applies to these really hyper-local kinds of examples that folks like us want to use the modeling in the real world for hyper-local issues.
Right. So climate change modeling as I mentioned, at least every 4 years in the international community, but you see different efforts. Army Corps of Engineers have been doing some of their own studies, NOAA, National Oceanic, and so they've all tried to approach the problem from different perspectives. For example, National Research Council tried to dial into observations gathered at tidal stations. And so they tried to put a bigger focus and bigger weight on that. And so they didn't necessarily do new modeling, but they focused on the West Coast of US. And they really zoomed into all of the measurements at tidal stations that we have. And so they tried to come up with the projection based on the historical values. So there are different perspectives, but the modelers are busy.
I really appreciate that. And good to know the science. There's, you know, commitment in the scientific community to continue to update it as all the factors change. That's good. And I'm hopeful we all commit to keeping plugged into that. But my question to Stephen is the practical use of the modeling that we've seen in the infrastructure. What's your expectation, Stephen, about how this data is going to be used to determine strategies to mitigate and adapt to the to the many assets, private and public assets, and associated costs to mitigate? And layered on top of that, are we going to take the modeling data and do further analysis about, you know, if it's one thing if a parking lot, a huge surface parking lot in the tide flats of Tacoma gets inundated with water for a week or two, and don't want that to happen, but it's one thing versus a chemical plant gets inundated with water, or the sewer treatment plant gets inundated with lots of water and it fails, or, you know, so we have hazards that can get really hazardous conditions that can get under water that, as we've witnessed with the modeling, and some natural sites. And if the natural sites get underwater, that's what they're there for. So what's the level of analysis on those two thoughts?
Yeah, and Councillor Mello, I may not be able to give you kind of a full comprehensive kind of response. I think we're still kind of working through many of those same questions. I do think that our expectation is that I think, first of all, what you're pointing to is this is more complicated than maybe we had initially anticipated. And I will just confess that there was a time in the past few years where I thought it might be, you know, the key decision is we need to decide what level of sea level rise we're planning for. And I think part of what we're hearing is different assets that we have in this area have different exposures. And so we may need to think in a little bit more of a systematic way about at what level of impact and exposure we can live with and adapt to, and then what kinds of adaptation measures do we need to consider. And in my mind, a lot of that comes into in our capital planning that'll be associated with this effort. Not just how do we adapt our existing infrastructure, how do we then, as we're planning for new investments in this area, think about the exposure that those new investments may have. We went through a couple of years back an exercise that was a really, really valuable exercise. And I think we had representatives from the county, city, port, and tribe at a minimum at that meeting. And it was really kind of looking at specific assets and infrastructure. And then what are the kind of the choices and what are some of the strategies that we need to think about in really adapting that? And one of the examples that came up was just in thinking about a roadway, if there's a road in the port that needs to be elevated, become more resilient to sea level rise, just thinking about that roadway system, the at-grade crossings with rail infrastructure, the driveway access to private and public development sites, that even thinking about how do we adapt that roadway system became very complicated in the level of coordination that we were going to need to think about how we adapt that infrastructure. So I think what we're thinking about is now is this helps us start to set the stage that as we go out for visioning process, that we're not visioning with our community about what we want the port to be in 30 or 40 years without thinking about sea level rise as a backdrop to that discussion. So that's the sort of the initial, I think, push is we want to have this data out so that when we're doing that initial research and outreach with our community, that we're really clear this isn't a blank canvas. There are things that are there today, and there's things that we can assume about what's going to be there or what might happen there over the next 20 or 30 or 40 years. So that's the first phase. Then as we start into the alternatives development and really then thinking about for the steering committee, what are really your thoughts on, you know, are there opportunities to support some shoreline retreat versus where do we need more armoring? I mean, there's going to be choices that we're going to have to make, I think, through this process, and then calculating and identifying what are the costs of those mitigation measures over time, and when do they need to come into play? So it's complicated. I know we're going to be thinking about this, I think, as a process from this initial outreach with our community all the way through plan development. But I think as Eunice was saying, the conversation may be more specific as we go through different assets and applying, I think, this kind of critical lens to those asset discussions rather than one sort of overall universal approach that we'll be taking. So I hope that gives you some insight, kind of where we're at with this conversation.
Yeah, it's a place we can't avoid it. We can't pretend like the risk isn't there. We would be absolutely foolish to pretend like it's not there and that we don't have to plan around it. So thank you.
Great. Thank you, Councilmember Mello. Are there any other comments and questions or questions? And just for the record, let the record show that Executive Dan Meyer joined us sometime during the presentation. Good to see you, Executive.
Hello. Thank you.
Yes, Chairman.
Yes, I appreciate the heads up of what's going to possibly happen down the road. But was there any look-see as what this can do to our fishery, salmon? Has there been any look-see into what this can do to our shellfish fishery? Has there been any look-see into some possible cultural sites that haven't been explored yet? And of course, you know, we're looking at this as far as our land goes. So anyway, that's pretty important to the Puyallup tribe. And I don't know what it all means yet, but any impact to what we have going now is gonna be a bad impact. So it's just something that's out there for anybody to think about and maybe down the road, throw that out on the table.
Yeah, and I just wanna thank you, Chairman Stewart. I think those are exactly the kinds of, questions today that are really helpful for us in thinking about how we structure this work over the next few months and then going into the environmental impact process. Because that's Certainly, I think we want to have a really good sense from you all, kind of what your specific priorities are, or some of the specific assets that you want to make sure that we are taking a deeper look at as we go through this process. So we may not have an answer on that today, but I think that's good direction for us to say that as we go through the next few months in this process, we're accounting for those scenarios.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you for bringing it up. Is there anything else that we're missing? I mean, is there anything else that we didn't see in this presentation that staff is looking at that we think that they need to be mindful of as we go into this process? All right. I see no additional hands. I see no additional questions or hands raised at this time. Stephen, Jonas, thank you so much for the in-depth presentation, and more than a presentation, it was an education for some of us. So thank you very much. I think Councilmember Mello said it, you know, it's not often we get to hear directly. We talk about climate change all the time, but it's not often we get that much of an in-depth presentation of what it actually looks like for Tacoma and Pierce County, especially as it relates to the port. So thank you very much for
that. My pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. With that, we will move on in the agenda. There's no more discussion on that issue. We'll move on in the agenda to item D, and that is the upcoming agenda, which is subject to change. So Stephen, do you want to talk about that? Stephen is the guy. Stephen is everything today.
I just try to keep that perception going. thank you. So Mayor, I think this is great to be sort of, I guess the old saying about tell them what you're going to tell them again. So the next meeting that we're planning on with the steering committee would be a joint meeting in March. In preparation for that, we will be preparing and providing to each of the governments and your full staff the draft baseline conditions report ahead of that meeting. The intent for that meeting is really to highlight some of the key takeaways. So we do not expect to go through kind of this in-depth on every chapter of that baseline report, because it will cover everything from air quality, water quality, cultural resources, transportation assets, a very comprehensive look. So that will be the intent of that meeting, is to start to pick out and identify some of the key takeaways, key data. What is it telling us that we need to pay particular attention to as we move into the next steps? And then as I mentioned, in February, we'll be having the kickoff meeting. So following that March joint meeting with the steering committee, what we'll be looking forward to is the next scheduled meeting in May and June. After we've concluded the visioning process, checked in and gotten feedback on the visioning process with our advisory group, we then will come back in May and June to really try to conclude this milestone for the alternatives development with the steering committee.
Great. Any questions about the upcoming agenda? And I do want to say this one thing we are going to have to do is we're going to have to look at the dates. I was just checking my calendar, and for some reason, this now, I don't know if we move from one Thursday to another, but this meeting now continuously bumps up against two other standing committee meetings that some of us have on our calendars. So we're going to look at having to move this from the second Thursday to potentially the third Thursday, if that works. But we'll get our staff working on that. We will meet in the month of March, but it may not exactly be on March 11th. Mayor Roscoe, you have unmuted yourself. Did you have something to say?
I just wanted to clarify that the baseline study will be transmitted without a presentation, and our group isn't meeting again until March, and at that point we'll meet with the stakeholder advisory group as well. Correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So we'll be meeting with the advisory group for that discussion.
Will the staff have a meeting, the staff level, will they have a meeting after the baseline report comes out?
Yeah, we're meeting, I guess I'd probably say 3 out of 4 weeks of the month currently, as we get through the baseline work, and then also the communications and outreach prep.
Thank you.
Right. All right, Commissioner McCarthy.
Thank you, Mayor. Stephen, I want to get a flavor for how many studies of this nature you anticipate are going to be developed through this process. Is this one of many or one of a few? And what are they? So I can somewhat understand the relative importance of this in the scheme of things.
Yeah, I think, I guess the way I'd probably characterize it, Commissioner McCarthy, is we, generally we'll be doing an area-wide CEPA planned action environmental impact statement. And that environmental review will be based on three kind of future development alternatives for the tide flats. But we want to make sure there's sort of two pieces that aren't necessarily directly maybe as kind of earmarked in the CEPA. So if anyone's familiar with the CEPA checklist, there's certain things, certain environmental impacts that we're supposed to look at as part of a CEPA checklist or an EIS. There's two particular things we want to make sure were not directly captured in that EIS, but really pertinent to this process. So one was sea level rise, because it's not necessarily a direct impact that development's going to have. It's more of, as we're planning for future use and development, what do we need to know about sea level rise to make those smart decisions about what's going to be located and where in the tide flats. The other piece of that is really the economic piece, that an EIS does not require an economic development review or impact assessment. And so that's the other piece that we want to really make sure it's not directly captured in an EIS. So that was the other piece that is looking at both the baseline conditions, but then also sort of that economic forecasting and projections to think about how might automation, affect employment, what industry trends can we forecast? What are our strengths today? And how do those match sectors that are expected to grow over the plan period? So those are the two that in particular, where there was a little bit more of a direct focus on these are real needs for this study that aren't captured necessarily under the EIS.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And that's exactly what I was hoping to hear is that, we'd have in terms of alternative economics and uses, et cetera, that was going to be a large part of the study. So you answered my question. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? So again, we will meet in March. We may just have to look at the date and work that out with everybody. Mm-hmm. All right. So with that, are there any, I can't believe we're getting here. Are there any other items of interest? I thought we were going to have a very robust discussion, but I think the presentation was so thorough that wasn't necessary. So are there any other items of interest? Seeing no other items of interest, I will give you back 34 minutes in your afternoon today. And I don't know about you all, but I saw Councilmember Brian Sands like, we never get back time, we only lose time in most cases. So I'll give you back 34 minutes or 33 minutes now in your afternoon and thank all of you for your participation today. And we look forward to seeing you in March.
Thank you.
All right. Happy New Year. Since this is the first time seeing this group, have a good week and be safe, everyone.
Thank you. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you all.